and welcome to a brand new episode of Radio Free Nintendo, courtesy of NintendoReport.com. Joining me today, Mike Sklens.
Hello.
And back from vacation, Jonathan Metz.
I am so pleased to be here.
Glad you're awake. And you told me earlier that you have new business, so let's jump right into that and tell me, Johnny, what's new and what's business?
Oh, okay. I finally crossed 100 hours in Pokemon Diamond.
Wow.
So I guess that's new business.
I haven't even beaten it yet.
I'm extremely close. I just got to the Pokemon League, so I'm about to fight the Elite Four, and I've decided that I'll stop playing once I do that. But I've never gotten that far. I played in Pokemon Blue. I got, like, maybe four badges, and then in Crystal, I didn't even get that far. So I've never I've never technically, like, beaten Pokemon, which I guess is what happens when you beat Elite Four. So I'm going to try to get to that point, and then I'll probably stop. I also picked up RE4 Wii Edition, which I have barely played. I was on vacation all week at the beach with my family, and my sister has a Wii, so I got it right before we went to the beach and took it with us, but I didn't want to get very far into it because I realized that because I didn't take my SD card, I wouldn't be able to bring my save file back with me, so I didn't want to have to like replay through a large chunk of the game.
An SD card.
That's something I'm really starting to dislike about. You know, I love that these consoles all have built-in storage, but the fact that it sort of locks your saves to your system drives me nuts sometimes.
They don't lock your save to your system if you have an SD card. It's just like having a memory card for all the older systems. But I didn't think of that because I don't think of the SD card as my memory card for game data files. So, and typically, I wouldn't have any reason to bring a memory card with me on vacation because we wouldn't really have a PS2 on vacation unless I brought my whole system. So what I was thinking about it on the bus on the way back to town today from the airport. The advent of your family members having Wiis brings on an interesting situation where it, you know, I've said a lot of times that currently there's really not any reason to buy an SD card, and Nintendo needs to fix that. They need to make it more useful. But the fact that you can save your game saves to it and then take it to someone else's house, for the first time, that's actually a useful feature for me because I actually have family members who own Wiis.
Right.
So I've never really had that situation crop up before, but now I actually have a reason to take that thing with me. So I need to start doing that. I didn't even think about it before I left. I was like, why would I take the SD card with me just so we can listen to my music on Excite Truck? Not worth it. I didn't think, we're going to have to reopen all the tracks in Excite Truck, et cetera.
Yeah.
Right.
So Excite Truck is awesome.
You'll enjoy Resident Evil 4. It's a very, very good port. It's very, very good.
Yeah, I plan to enjoy it throughout the week.
Did you ever play the PS2 version for the Ada missions?
Hell no.
No?
No, there's no way I could play through it with worse graphics after having played it on GameCube with good graphics.
Well, it's not that much worse, I mean.
I saw the comparison screenshots and I knew I wouldn't be able to handle it.
And it's not worth another $50 just to play 8 missions.
No, it's not.
That's true.
$30 to play it with a new control scheme and with all the extra content is definitely worth it.
Yeah.
And true widescreen. So, there you go. Though, Johnny does not have a widescreen TV, so he can't take advantage of that.
Nope.
Wah, 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 wah. Anyway, let's go ahead and move on to community. And the hot topic was extended one more week about E3, so we're going to go ahead and skip that this week and go straight to listener mail, which isn't really listener mail this week because we didn't receive that much listener mail that was of quality that I could put on the show. So if you send listener mail this week.
We did get some, but it wasn't very good.
We did get some, but you know, it was mostly fart jokes and spam, so no good.
Yeah.
So I pulled one of the many, many, many responses that we got last week from the show in the forum. Essentially, you know, Mike, Wendy, and I talked about Nintendo's current relationship with its hardcore gamers. And for the most part, Mike and I thought that they weren't doing a very good job of appealing to them as well as their new market. And Wendy disagreed with that, and apparently all of our listeners agreed with Wendy.
Yeah.
And one such listener was True Nerd, who says, "Oh, Mike and Carl, you claim that Nintendo has cut their resources in half, one devoted to hardcore gamers and the other to casual gamers, and yet I am completely unable to remember the last time that we, the Nintendo hardcore gamers, have gotten as good a lineup as the one we're about to get for the rest of the year. Most years we've got one premier title. This year we've got three, four if you include Phantom Hourglass. The lineup for the rest of the year is pretty much as good as it could be for hardcore gamers, and anyone who says otherwise is simply wrong."
We're wrong. I don't think we're wrong. I think we've gotten lineups like this. There was the one E3 year with Mario, Metroid, and Zelda, and that's akin to this. But at the same time, there was a ton more supporting content for the hardcore gamer or the true Nintendo fan, as you might want to call them.
Sure.
But this year, we've got these premier titles, and we've got these four huge titles, but then all the supporting content is non-existent because it's all the resources for those titles have been pushed off to the blue ocean.
Exactly.
There is supporting hardcore content. There's stuff like, I mean, coming from Nintendo even, there's stuff like Fire Emblem, mm-hmm. which is very hardcore.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And I think stuff like Battalion Wars 2 also is pretty hardcore.
See, I guess I don't put Battalion Wars on the list because it's not very good, so it just seems like, oh, if it's not quality, I'm not even going to consider it.
I never really played the retail version of the first one, yeah, but I'm kind of looking forward to this one because it seems like they're doing, if they're improving it as much as they seem to have improved Mario Strikers, then it'll probably be worth checking out. And the online play is a very nice feature to have for this type of game.
Sure.
So I'm looking forward to not necessarily owning it, but possibly owning it, depending on what I read about it and what I hear about it.
Waiting on those reviews.
Yeah. Fire Emblem I have no interest in, but I'm sure Carl will.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm definitely waiting for that review copy.
Zero interest.
Is it really? You're not a big Fire Emblem guy?
Zero for me.
I have the first Fire Emblem for Game Boy, the first one that came out on Game Boy Advance, and I liked it, but like, I don't have the time or patience to invest in those kind of games anymore.
Well, what I really like about Fire Emblem, and I know that we're going on a little divergence here, but I don't care because I like Fire Emblem. You know, I before playing Path of Radiance, I was not a big strategy guy, zero interest in the series whatsoever. Like, I didn't really care about it. I got Path of Radiance hooked me in. And what I like about it is that it's an RPG where there's no fluff. It's all battle to battle to battle.
It's a tactics game.
Well, sure. But I mean, there's no, you know, part where you have to explore a town where, you know, you're wasting time, basically. You go from, it's all meat, and none of that, you know, superfluous stuff that you don't really need. And, you know, for an RPG, you can beat it surprisingly quickly.
Well, Carl, I guess the thing that doesn't appeal to me about Fire Emblem is that I've played a lot of other games just like it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Tactics Ogre stuff, the Final Fantasy Tactics stuff, even Ogre Battle is very much a strategy game with kind of RPG trappings, but there's no exploration, there's no, you know, there's a story that's force-fed to you and is very dramatic and soap opera-like. And in some ways that stuff appeals to me, but I don't need one after the other after the other after the other. And the problem is there's just not enough differentiation among these different series, much less from one game to the other. As far as I can tell, the Fire Emblem for Wii is almost exactly the same thing as the one for GameCube. It has different maps.
You'll be able to
point
at it.
It continues the story, but there are no new features. There's not even really true Wii control.
No.
And it's basically just like, how quickly can we crank out a sequel?
Oh, no,
and
it's,
I don't even understand that, because the first game certainly did not sell that well that they should think there's like a built-in market for this. It seems like they, you know, they do stuff like with Phantom Hourglass, where the focus is on reaching people who have heard of Zelda but have been afraid to pick it up before because of the higher barrier of entry. And Zelda doesn't even have that high of a barrier, whereas Fire Emblem absolutely does. Mm-hmm. And this is a series that they need to do things to broaden it out to a broader market and still keep the core gameplay, and they haven't done that at all with the one for Wii. It was like, let's get this out as quickly as possible.
And it just didn't come out that quickly.
Yeah, it's been out
in Japan
for a really long time.
But it took a long time to localize. And I respect that, but it just, there's nothing in it for me, really.
Yeah.
There's not.
And there's practically
and I like
no
strategy
market in
games,
America.
And there's still nothing in it for me.
I suppose I just haven't been burned out on strategy games yet.
Yeah, I guess so. And
I just
that's
don't
cool,
like them.
Man. That's cool. I have, though. I'm totally burned out on them.
But aren't you a big Advance Wars fan?
No.
No?
See, that's
I played the original Advance Wars for Game Boy Advance.
Okay.
Well, I say original. There were a lot of Wars games before that, but I played the first one that was actually called Advance Wars. And I liked it, but all the rest of them that have come after that are no different.
Sure.
Yeah, I didn't play. I played Advance Wars, and I kind of liked it, and I was like, this is okay. And then, you know, I guess I was in a real strategy kick because I got Fire Emblem, and I thought, this is okay. And then I realized they're practically the same game.
Yeah.
I mean, one's, you know, Modern Warfare, and the other one is Fantasy, and if a dude dies, he dies for good. That's like the only thing that makes Fire Emblem Fire Emblem to me, is that if, when a dude dies, he's gone forever.
Right.
But like, and then I realized that I just really don't like these games very much. They're slow and they take forever. Like the I always like have to think out like 17 turns in advance and I get bogged down in it and I get bored. I'd rather play StarCraft.
Amen.
Well, screw you guys, I like it.
We never really answered this guy's question. So my feeling is, I'm with Mike on this one. I think this particular year we're getting a boom of premier hardcore titles. And I love it. But the same thing happened with GameCube. And what you saw is that after that, things really trickled down big time. I mean, the so-called hardcore game of 2005 was Mario Kart. And that's it. And that's not even a very hardcore game at all. So,
Nintendo's had this problem. Like, if you look at, you know, like the Xbox 360, it seems that almost every game coming out between now and December is like this massive, huge title, starting with BioShock and ending, and then moving into Halo 3 and then Grand Theft Auto, and, you know, like there's just, and Mass Effect is coming out and Half-Life 2, and it's just all these massive, massive, massive titles. And Wii just does not have that.
No, Wii does have that this year.
This year, yeah.
I just don't think they're going to have it next year because historically we have no proof for that. So yeah. I hope it happens. I hope next year we get Metroid Prime 4 and Mario Galaxy 2 and Pikmin, for goodness sake, and new franchises for the hardcore people. But I think what we're seeing now is that the reason that people are worried about this, and they probably have some reason to be worried about it, is that all of the new IPs, you know, people always say Nintendo needs to come out with new series. Well, they are, but all the new series are for casual people. There are no new series for the hardcore. The hardcore is, let's throw some mascots up in your face and you better like it.
Yeah.
And the thing is that hardcore gamers don't, it's a weird perception at Nintendo that hardcore gamers want the mascots. I don't think that's true at all. I think historically, casual gamers have been the ones who buy games purely based on the fact that Mario's face fills up 90% of the box art. Not yeah. Hardcore people. Hardcore people want interesting gameplay and advances in that field. And you know, throwing out mascot games is not necessarily the way to do that. So right.
Like Mario Galaxy is definitely going to do that. You know, it's pushing things in new directions. But what do we have that's coming out next year? Like, there's nothing on the horizon, and from what Nintendo's done in the past, it doesn't look like there will be much on the horizon. Next year's big holiday game, it's probably going to be Wii Fit, you know?
It could be if it doesn't come out before then. Right. Yeah, I think not only are all of Nintendo's original IPs geared more towards the casual gamer now,
Except for Metroid, really.
Metroid's not an original new IP. I'm talking about new stuff like
you said,
like
original
Wii Fit
IPs,
and
Nintendogs
and Brain Age.
Oh yeah,
etc. Wii casual. Sports. All of these are new IPs, and that's what Nintendo needs to be doing. They need to be coming out with stuff that doesn't have the number 5 on the end of the game title. Mm-hmm. But when they do that, they're almost every single time for the past 3 or 4 years, those are for casual gamers, and so that's why the hardcore is worried about this. And not only that, but parallel next to that, the hardcore series are becoming more casual bit by bit. You can see in Mario Galaxy, there's a tendency to do things that will broaden the perspective of it. You can certainly see that in Phantom Hourglass for the Zelda series and all of
Metroid's
comments about
shooter.
What he wants to do for Wii and the next games. So I think people are seeing not only that they're not getting any new hardcore series, but that the existing ones are being geared more towards casual gamers. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does worry certain people.
What we're getting is lots of like really great, really obscure, quirky Japanese titles like Elite Beat Agents or Professor Layton. That stuff's coming over, and the hardcore is going to buy that. But the problem is that we're not getting the big budget hardcore anymore.
Right. The big budgets are going more towards the casual gamers because that's where the money is.
Yeah.
That's where Nintendo sees the money is. Microsoft is banking that the money is still in the hardcore market. And if you believe them and you want crazy amounts of hardcore stuff every single month, you should get a 360 in addition to your Wii.
I love mine. I mean, I can think of a huge game coming out every month. And coming out for my Xbox, and I cannot say the same for Nintendo.
Waiting for the price drop. Over here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, especially because it's definitely coming, like, in 2 or 3 weeks now.
Yeah,
probably. You haven't been here on the internet with us for the past couple weeks, Johnny, but a couple days ago, scans leaked from Toys R Us and Walmart flyers with price drops in them. So it's definitely coming in, like, 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, that's good for people who are interested in casual games. For hardcore games. For people who are interested in hardcore Nintendo games, this will be a very good year. Next year remains to be seen, but I wouldn't be too optimistic. I wouldn't expect next year to be as good as this year for the hardcore Nintendo gamer.
Definitely not. I mean, it takes a couple of years development to make a huge Nintendo game like Mario or Twilight Princess or something, and they've all, you know, blown their loads and they're all in reset mode, and it's going to be 3 or 4 years before we get another huge Zelda game or another huge Mario game. So what's going to fill the void? It's going to be Mario Kart and, you know, stuff that's not really that huge.
Well, you would hope that there will be stuff from third parties that will appeal to Nintendo fans as well, but we'll see. I think a lot of the new third-party support that Wii is getting will be concentrating on casual games, so I don't think that's going to help the situation much either. But we'll see.
Seems very, very likely. Okay then, guys, we're going to go ahead and move on to our next segment after this quick break, so come back for the news. Alright guys, welcome to the news section. First up, VC Mondays. Today, Star Soldier, Dynamite Heady, and Drop Off were released on the NES, Genesis, and TurboGrafx-16 areas, respectively.
You've probably never heard of any of these games. If I hadn't read Chris Kohler's Game Life today, I wouldn't know that Dynamite Heady is a game made by Treasure.
Which is sweet.
And is apparently pretty sweet, but I've never heard of it. And
yeah, that's probably the one here that's worth your interest.
Yeah,
worth your research. Star Soldier.
Is Star Soldier the same as like the TurboGrafx game that's already on for 12
I'm pretty sure it's worse. So I don't
really. I mean,
dollar more and get the TurboGrafx one, or better yet, pay a couple dollars more and get a much better game like Gradius 3, or you know, there's so many shooters. Of all the shoot 'em ups available on Virtual Console Mondays, you probably shouldn't get any of the ones for NES because they're all pretty bad.
Yeah,
until
they're all
Capcom
so
releases 1942.
1942?
I loved 1942 growing up. That's probably just
for NES?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, probably just because I owned it. And I was like six.
I've played the arcade version. I just can't imagine the NES version is any good at all. It's going to be such a massive downgrade from the arcade version.
I played it. It's all right. It's not too bad.
Let's face it. There aren't many good shooters for NES. There are lots of good ones for Super NES that still haven't come out.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful that we'll see more of those. There's lots of ones on TurboGrafx that I've never heard of before that are already out, and probably a lot more that are still coming out.
Yeah.
But for NES, it's slim pickings, buddy.
Well, I mean, there are tons and tons of shooters to pick from on Virtual Console, so I'm sure you can find one that's better than Star Soldier.
Yeah. And maybe Super Star Soldier, which costs a dollar more.
Yeah. And I've heard drop-off is also not so great. So, yeah. Look forward to our VC Mondays roundup. Check out Dynamite Heady, see how it did, and maybe download it. Moving on to the real news, first up, Viva Pinata has been announced for the DS at Comic-Con with a new top-down view.
That's pretty huge. I mean, you know, it certainly lends credence to the fact that Microsoft is... I mean, well, they've done it before, but it lends credence to the fact that Microsoft's willing to put games on a Nintendo platform.
Yeah, they should keep doing that, you know?
It gets more interesting, though. It's developed by Rare...
Yeah,
and it's going to retain the same gameplay of the original.
It's going to be essentially not really a port because it's obviously going to be built from the ground up. But it'll be Viva Pinata on your DS.
But yeah. it's a new engine. Of course, it has to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is the same game basically.
Essentially,
except
now it's on
the platform where its market actually exists.
Yes, and hopefully it's going to retain all of the cool online features. I mean, on DS. I hate
the whole game. All the online features were passive in the Xbox version, if I remember correctly.
Oh, so
maybe
it's not going to work too well with friend codes. In other words,
I think you could just friend. You could send your friends things or that kind of stuff. But I don't know there was no actual interactivity between players. I don't believe.
No.
Well, then maybe you don't need friend codes. Maybe it could be like Global Trading Station from Pokemon, where basically. it has online features, but since you're not directly playing with someone else for that particular feature, then you won't have to have a friend. In that case,
but you
it might work.
Well, you might still need friend codes if you want to send something for free specifically to your friend.
For Animal Crossing kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But for like the general mingling of your piñatas and stuff like that, that could work without it. That could be cool.
It could work. So look forward to more on that soon, I hope. Dragon Quest 4, 5, and 6, however, coming to DS, still 2D, awesome.
That's huge. I mean, obviously Square knows what they're doing. I mean, this is their bread and butter, is remaking old franchises on new platforms right now.
Now, they remade 4 for Super Nintendo and then for PlayStation, and then for, I think, for PlayStation 2 as well, oddly enough.
Jeez.
And I know they remade 5 and 6. They originally came out on Super NES or Super Famicom, and they remade them for PlayStation. But 5 and 6 have never come out in English. So hopefully these DS versions are going to force Square Enix to finally release English versions of these.
Well, also happened with Final Fantasy 3.
4 is awesome. 4 is excellent. And I really want to play 5 and 6. I've heard a lot of good things about them. So hopefully they're going to come to America eventually.
Pretty freaking sweet. So yeah, I mean, Square Enix is really, really port happy lately. I mean, they're remaking Final Fantasy 4, 5, and 6 in 3D on the DS. They're releasing Dragon Quest 4, 5, and 6 on the DS.
It's cheap and makes them a ton of money.
Did they ever completely confirm that Final Fantasy 5 and 6 are coming out on DS?
Yeah.
I know we all assumed that, but they did confirm it?
No, they didn't.
Yeah, they did.
When did that happen?
What, like, right after the big thing about Final Fantasy 4 came out, they're like, oh, yeah, we're also making 5 and 6 in 3D on DS.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm hardly surprised, but I just didn't remember them actually explicitly saying that. But that's cool if they did.
Yeah, they can reuse the cinemas from the PlayStation version.
I guess the 2D part of this announcement, that the Dragon Quest games on DS are going to be in 2D, is a little weird because they've already got Dragon Quest Monsters Joker in 3D. It has a beautiful 3D engine, and it's sold over a million copies in Japan. It's coming out later this year in America. And then Dragon Quest 9 is going to be in 3D. So they have a great engine that presents the Dragon Quest style art style and everything very nicely in 3D. So I guess it is a bit odd that they're doing this in 2D. But yeah, I think this is basically like assembly line outsourcing, you know, what can Tosei do it as fast as possible. So yeah, I guess that's why.
Well, it's also important to know that they're changing the view. It's actually isometric now. Instead of
what
it was before.
That makes me think, you know, I think the PlayStation ports of these games were isometric. So probably these are going to basically be ports of the PlayStation versions.
Could be.
And that's cool. That's good. We never got those in America either.
Right.
As long as they translate these into English, I don't care if they show all the action from the characters' feet looking up at their faces.
You just want to play it.
I just want to play it, man.
Well, speaking of blockbuster franchises, Pokemon Diamond and Pearl has hit a new milestone. Since it was released in Europe last week, it has now sold 10 million units worldwide.
Ka-ching!
that's a big milestone.
Yeah.
That is huge.
Even for Pokemon.
By the way, that's more copies of Pokemon sold than there are Xbox 360s, PlayStation 3s, and Wii's all combined.
No.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
No, it's not. The Xbox is right about to hit 10 million, Johnny. Yeah. I remember reading a little while ago.
Maybe
it really did? 360 hit 10 million?
No, it's at like 9 point something right now, and the Wii is at like 8 something.
Okay. My bad.
So maybe in America.
My bad. I'm making up exaggerated, hyperbolic statements about sales figures.
It's certainly more than PlayStation 3s exist. Well, anyway, it's more than any of the three systems
have
around
sold
the market. Yeah,
sure.
It's a hell of a lot.
It's just one game.
And how many DSs have been sold worldwide? Right now it had to be like, what, 45, 50 million?
A gazillion and a half.
Man, so it's getting up there.
That's like for every one out of four or five DSs sold, a copy of Pokemon has been sold. That is ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it's a large percentage for sure.
That is ridiculous penetration. I mean, I remember the original duo of Red and Blue only sold something like they're at like 11 or 12 million worldwide.
Yeah, the DS version is definitely on pace.
So it's doing well.
It could be the best selling Pokemon game yet.
Oh yeah, it's hitting milestones already.
I think it's on its way.
and it just hit Europe. It still has time to go.
It's only been out in America for a couple months.
Well, it's been out since April, so that's...
Yeah, but Pokemon has more legs than any other franchise out there.
Yeah, I mean, last week crazy we talked legs. About the, last week we talked about the NPDs. It's still in the top 10.
Yeah.
So, there you go. It'll
be in the top 10. Hell, wasn't it like the number 2 and the number 3 last month?
Yeah, something like that.
It was like,
that's
it was,
for June.
I think it was 4 and 5, actually, but still, really, really impressive.
Yeah.
Very, very impressive.
I think it'll carry itself through, because there'll be a lot of kids getting DSs for Christmas.
Always, yeah.
Well, speaking of cash money franchises, Guitar Hero 2 has solidified Activision as the number one third party.
That's pretty huge. I mean, they've topped EA for a month, you know?
Yeah,
well,
but
they've kind of flipped back and forth at times. Activision has been the number one third party before, and then EA definitely took over for quite a while. But I'm not surprised. EA hasn't really put out anything really mega huge for a while. Now, Harry Potter... is probably going to be a big seller for the month of July, and may push them back
over. For June,
they
had NCAA.
And Madden's coming.
For July, they had NCAA. Next month, they'll have Madden.
Right. And then Madden will do it. Madden will push them back over. Until Guitar Hero 3 comes out, and then maybe.
But then Rock Band.
They got Rock Band.
So...
I think we all know that Guitar Hero 3, sales-wise, is going to destroy Rock Band.
I don't think so.
No, I think it will, because it'll be cheaper, and it's an established franchise, and
exactly.
It'll be available.
It has the name recognition, it's much less expensive, you could buy a copy of it and not have to buy any hardware. You could buy it for $50 and be playing Guitar Hero 3, and you've already got your wireless controllers for PS2 or whatever.
You know, I'm not so sure about that, because you can actually use the Guitar Hero 2 controller in Rock Band.
Okay, that's confirmed, but that still doesn't change the fact that Rock Band has absolutely no brand equity right now.
Well, it's got the MTV brand behind it, and it's also got, you know, it's got the big EA push, and it's got...
But it doesn't have the franchise.
Let's just say that within 6 months to a year, Rock Band could be competitive with Guitar Hero on a sales basis, but when it first comes out, no.
It's
going to take a while for Rock Band to build up its reputation and for people to say, oh, this is like Guitar Hero, but better.
They should sell it on harmonics. They should, in the commercial, it should be from the people who brought you Guitar Hero.
Most people don't know who... Well, yeah, if they say
like,
from
do
the
it
people
like a
who brought you Guitar Hero,
yeah.
That will work. If
they
say
need
from
to do
harmonics,
it like
that will not work.
You know, from the people, from the producers of... You know, because people buy like, oh, this guy produced that movie, so obviously the sequel is going to be the same. No, that's not how it is at all, you know, but... That's how Activision is going to sell Guitar Hero 3.
That will help them. Also, the other big advantage that Guitar Hero 3 has, it's coming out on every platform known to man. Now, Rock Band eventually will, I believe, but it's going to take longer for that to happen.
This year,
so that's why I say
it's
going to take
Xbox
about a year for Rock Band to really penetrate the market and become a force like Guitar Hero has.
But the difference is that Rock Band is also designed from its heart to be, you know, Harmonix says this, it's designed to be a platform. You know, it is a $200, or supposedly $200 platform that you buy, and new content. They will be releasing a full album from a band every week, is what they've said they're going for. They've already announced the Who's Next and Nirvana's Nevermind are both going to be the whole album you can play in Rock Band, and they said they're going to do a whole album every week in addition to other songs every week. This is a full-on, you know, it's the iTunes music of video games.
Yes, Obi. We all know Rock Band will be cool. It will probably be way the hell better than Guitar Hero 3. From a sales point of view, Guitar Hero 3 will dominate Rock Band for quite a while.
I agree.
Eventually,
totally.
They may equal out eventually. That's all I'm saying.
I'm not so sure, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see on that.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking about money a lot on this episode. And we got another money story coming up. Because Nielsen has found that we owners are more quote-unquote upscale. In a sampling of console ownerships, people who owned Wiis were the most likely to be belonging to families making more than 100 grand per year.
This is surprising because Wii is also the cheapest system. You'd think the answer would be the PS Triple, but it's not.
Not so much.
I think kind of what this means is that the Wii is being seen as like a cool piece of electronics... Like an iPod, in other words.
Yeah, it's got an iPod.
It's not that it's being bought by people with the most... In other words, people aren't buying it because it's the most powerful piece of hardware. Like say I've always been music players that were more powerful than the iPod, that could hold more, etc.
I would argue that to the death, but okay.
iPod is the one that's easiest to use.
It's got
interface.
And Wii
is the one that is easiest to use.
Well, and again, when you look at that, Wii has got the interface. That's the killer app on both the iPod and the Wii.
Of course, yes.
Mm. So there you go. I mean, it's a cool thing to have. So rich people have
it. I mean, how many people have it and barely ever touch it? They just have it to have it, or they have it and they only have Wii Sports, and they will only ever have Wii Sports, maybe buy one game a year kind of situation.
Yeah. And, wow, we have another money story.
Every article Good except Lord. For the virtual consoles was about money.
Oh, it's all about that money. That cash money, baby. Last up, the Australian gaming industry is now worth $1
billion. $1 billion Australian dollars.
Which means it's...
something like 760 million American.
Meaning it will buy you one Coke in Disneyland.
That is a lot of cash money.
Yeah. But it begs Skrilla, the question, Skrilla. Did we even know there was an Australian gaming industry?
Oh, come on. No, don't get our Australian correspondent sad.
Oh, poor Casey. But yeah, the Australian gaming industry is now worth $1 billion. And there are some well-known studios in Australia, I think.
What is it? The guys who did, what's his name? I can't remember. They did some game that I played at E3 one year, and I thought it was kind
of
interesting.
Wow, good job there. Yeah, there are a lot of them.
Way to go, Australia.
There are a lot
of
them.
Sorry, Australia.
Atari has one, which unfortunately they're not doing a whole lot right now.
Yeah.
The new Spyro the Dragon game is being made in Australia.
Oh, is that Chrome? Is Chrome in Australia?
You have Chrome? Tantalus down there.
Tantalus, that's the one.
They're making some handheld stuff, so.
Right. So there you go. Chrome, Australia has some good studios.
Yeah. No Canada, but
They're no Canada. They're no Croatia.
Well, they're growing.
Sure. Good for you, Australia. Way to go.
Welcome to club.
G'day. All right. We're gonna go ahead and take another break. When we come back, we're talking about our feature, which is what makes a game a 10 for you. Alrighty, folks, and welcome back to our feature. You know, we got a lot of heavy name titles coming out this year, a lot of AAA stuff coming out on all three systems and PC. So it begs the question, are there going to be any 10 out of 10 games reviewed, in various media sources all across the internet? And it also begs the question, what makes a game a 10 for us? Now, we've been talking about this a little earlier, and Johnny, why don't we start with you? What do you think makes a game a 10?
Okay, well, first of all, I've said this many times, I've written about it, but I don't think there's such a thing as a perfect game. If games are works of art, as I think all three of us believe that they are in some form, or that they can be art, I don't believe there's such a thing as a perfect piece of art. I don't think there's such a thing as a perfect piece of music. It just doesn't work out that way. For that reason, I don't think you can have perfection in gaming. I don't think it's possible. But especially in gaming, I think it's almost always very obvious, no matter how superb a game is, it's usually immediately obvious how you could make it better. You could always add more to it, or you could make this certain part of it more streamlined, or you could make the graphics better with newer technology, etc. I mean, I believe for when it came out, a game like Final Fantasy VI was a 10, was worth a 10. I think it was absolutely incredible game that a lot more people should have played than did. But now, you can say now that you can improve the game by making the graphics better so that the story comes across in a different way that appeals to a broader audience but still retains the core of it. So you can always improve on something, and if you can improve on it, then it wasn't perfect to begin with. So I would never say that a game is perfect, okay? For me, a 10 is not a game that approaches perfection. It's not a hyperbola. There's no asymptote of perfection that games can approach and get closer and closer and closer to. That's ridiculous. It's not possible. For me, a 10 is a game that does something so incredible that it completely rises above almost everything else that is currently available. It rises above all of its competitors. It does something truly remarkable. It either does something that has been done before, but raises it to a completely new plateau of excellence, or it does something that no one has ever done before, and is obviously something that's worth doing, something that's totally innovative and amazing at the same time. And often, for me, a game that gets a score of a 10 is something that does a lot of both of those in a lot of different areas. In other words, it's almost like an amazing, perfect storm of so many different elements of artistry, of technical brilliance, of innovation, that all come together, you know, at the right time. So for me, that's the kind of thing that it comes to. And it's not something that I think, well, this game could be a 10, blah, blah, blah. To me, if a game is a 10, it almost just screams out at me from the moment I play it. It's like, oh my God, this is incredible. This is a majestic experience.
Okay.
And it's really almost hard for me to criticize a game if I believe it has that it's worth a 10. It's like, obviously there are flaws in it. I could pick things out from it and say, well, this could be a little better, etc. You can do that for any game ever made. But for me, a game that's worth a 10 is a game that has so many incredible merits that it's just almost not even worth mentioning the flaws, because they're not important. To me, for a game that's a 10, a game that's a 10 is a game that basically everyone should play it. It's a game that I wish I could get my parents to sit down and play, you know? Because I think they could appreciate it if they would give it a chance. It's that good. It deserves to be played by everyone. And for me, when a game is like that, if you sit down and try to break it up into pieces and say, well, this part's really, you know, has some problems with it, the only thing that serves to do is to discourage people from playing it, when in fact, everyone should play it.
Okay. That's very, well,
fine. I know, I went on forever.
Thorough.
You should drop out of grad school and reapply as some sort of game philosophy major.
Yeah, Johnny, you should review games.
Hey, I should try this.
So, Johnny, what would you say are some 10 out of 10s for you? Just, you know, games that you play that you think are 10s.
I actually have the list of games that Johnny has given 10s if you don't have.
Okay, yeah, I'm actually at the website trying to do that right now.
You've got Resident Evil 4 for the GameCube, Super Mario Sunshine, also GameCube, Legend of Zelda, Wind Waker. That's it. Those are the three.
Yeah.
Those are the only three I've given.
Wow. For reviews. I mean, you haven't reviewed every 10, maybe, you know?
Yeah, we have a lot of 10s, but those are the three that you doled out.
Right.
Yeah.
And any others besides those, really?
Say what?
Any other games besides those that you would give 10s to if you were to review them?
Like from other eras or... Yeah, sure.
Any other game.
But nothing that pops off the top of my head. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to conjecture here because I really would have to think about... I'd have to think about it for a little while before I would really want to commit to that. But I count at least four here. I've got Resident Evil 4, Twilight Princess,
oh, yeah,
Wind Waker, and Mario Sunshine.
Oh, I missed one of those, sorry.
Yeah. All great games, all really, really exemplary examples of their genre. So.
Of those, the most controversial has been Mario Sunshine. But I think in the review itself, I put up a very good defense for me giving that the score that I did.
Well, actually,
again, it's a game that has problems, and in retrospect, some of those problems may be more significant than I spelled out in the review at the time. But I still don't think the problems are worth someone saying, "Oh, well, I don't want to play it because of that problem." You right. know, I think the problems are worth putting up with, and to the point that I really don't even. You know, unless we're getting around in a circle and say, hey, let's talk about all the things that are wrong with Mario Sunshine, I don't really feel comfortable talking about what's wrong with that game because I don't want to discourage people from trying it.
Sure.
Well, I think it's sort of, what I think it's great about Mario Sunshine is that even though it's got the whole, like, I don't know, water squirting thing, I still think it's like a really, really pure platforming game. And I think that's sort of, to get into what I think what makes a game a 10 is not that it's perfect, because as Johnny says, I agree. There's no way to be anything to be perfect truly. Though I do maybe sort of agree with the asymptote of perfection. theory, and I also just like saying asymptote of perfection. But I think what makes a game a 10 in my book is that it's just, like, it's pure in some aspect. Looking on the site, the two games that I've reviewed that I've given 10s are Prince of Persia: The Sands of Time and Mario Kart DS, and I gave them both 10s, and I gave them 10s for completely opposite reasons. Mario Kart DS is a pure gameplay experience. It is probably the best that, you know, battle-based kart racing will ever get, I think. You know, sure, it's got its flaws, like snaking, but that's, you know, it's something that jerks are really good at and kind of ruins the game for everybody else, but it's still the best. It's the best Mario Kart, hands down. It's,
oh, yeah.
It's perfect. It's got great level design, ton of characters, does Wi-Fi play, you know, it's got everything. And it's just a pure gameplay experience. And on the opposite end, Prince of Persia: The Sands of Time, I gave a 10 because it is a fantastic game with a pure storytelling experience. This is a game that was so ambitious for its time. It's a grand cinematic adventure, except there are almost no cinema scenes in the game. Everything takes place during the game. Farah and the prince talk to each other, you know, while you're running around the levels. The game is insanely gorgeous to look at, thanks not only to the graphics, which were great for their time and still look pretty damn good today, but the animation and the cinematography of the game, if you can say a game has cinematography, like the way the lighting works and like the particle effects coming together and the way the animation and the animation works with the camera and makes everything you do look the coolest, like as cool as it possibly could. It, you know, visually it's stunning, and then story-wise, they managed to take a love story and wrap it into a video game, and it plays out while you play the video game. And even though it's got its blemishes, like the combat system is kind of mediocre, I would say. It's very, you know, just, you know, lather, rinse, repeat kind of combat where it just keeps throwing enemies at you. It's not bad. It doesn't bring the game down. It's just not the shining high point of the game that the story is. And the way that these guys worked on this game to make it the perfect storytelling experience is why I gave that game a 10.
You know, and I think that's a case where in the attempt, when Ubisoft made the sequel to that game, their attempts to fix what people saw as the flaw of Sands of Time really brought down the series as a whole.
Oh, yeah. Well, what did they do?
They were like, oh, well, people didn't like the combat very much, so we should put more focus on the combat and try to make it better.
Yeah, they should have put more focus on
the platforming.
That's
exactly the opposite of what they should have done.
The best parts of Prince of Persia were the platforming, where you're running up walls and then, you know, jumping from thing to thing to thing and then dodging spikes, and you're doing all this in rapid succession, and the way the camera moves and the way you play it, it just makes you feel like a total freaking badass.
Well, see,
and on top of
this is funny, Obi, because what you said before, now you're talking about the platforming as being the best part of it, but what you were saying before is all about the story.
Well, see, that's the thing.
In fact,
those two parts
my favorite
are so
part
good.
Of that game is the platforming. But, well, I think this gets back to the original topic of what makes the game a perfect, well, not a perfect, what makes the game, it's hard to say that because perfect and 10 is like a phrase. It's like common English phrase. It's hard to separate those two words to get from each other. But I think what makes this game a 10 for you, and probably for me as well, is that it doesn't just have a great way of telling a story. It doesn't just have really awesome, innovative platforming. It excels in multiple areas, and they all come together to make one very tight experience.
Yeah, it's a
synergy
thing.
All these things work together, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Very true, very true.
But then,
you've given one score of 10.
I give it 1
to 10. Elite Beat Agents.
Yeah, and I stand by that very, very much, in that it is, and I know you hate the word perfect, but for me, I would say that game was a perfect experience. In that there was no, in a lot of games that I like, even like in Killer 7 and even in Fire Emblem Path of Radiance, which I gave a 9 and a 9.5 to, there were segments that were a little slow that I didn't particularly care for. Elite Beat Agents is like it's constantly on high. Like, there's no point where
I think you've mistaken the word high for insanely difficult.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, yeah. Well, depending on what difficulty you're playing on there, it's manageable. But, and it's, like, the experience never tires down. You're always having fun. You're always having a great time. You can play it in short bursts and just play one song, or you can play through an entire, you know, plethora of songs and play for, like, a good solid 2 hours. And there's enough replay value in it that you can go back to it over and over again. And not only that, it doesn't just have awesome rhythm gameplay. It also has a great set of these quirky you know, comic-inspired stories that are very funny to go through, and, you know, great dialogue, awesome localization. Well, not really localization because they made it in English, but, you know, great writing, and it's the experience was, for me, one of the best I've ever had in a video game ever.
I think the thing that's great about Elite Beat Agents is it's the type of game where you can get into sort of that zen state where the rest of the world completely disappears, and you may as well just be sitting in, you know, an abyss of blackness holding your DS and playing that game, because that is how incredibly focused you get while playing it, and it sort of, you know, it just makes everything else vanish and it completely absorbs you into it.
When I finally beat Jumpin' Jack Flash, I had been playing the game for about 2 hours straight, and when I finally beat it, I threw my hands up into the air. I didn't say anything, but because I was in public, but I did throw my hands in the air.
Did you wave them like you just did not care?
Yes. And
I have a similar experience, actually, playing Guitar Hero, the original, on hard, and finally beating, or maybe it was on expert, I forget, finally beating for the first time after playing it for hours and hours and hours and hours, finally beating Cowboys from Hell. I took the guitar, flipped it over, grabbed it by the neck, and I smashed it into the couch. And I didn't want to break it, but I was so freaking amped that I had to, like, smash the guitar, so I smashed it into the couch, and in the process, I completely threw off the tilt sensor, and it's a real pain in the ass to get it to tilt. That's why I got a new guitar with Guitar Hero 2.
Sure. But yeah, you know, I mean, Elite Beat Agents was just such a great experience for me, and, you know, I threw my hands in the air, and that's when I knew, this game is a 10.
Yeah, it's just kind of the, as a reviewer, to give out a score like 10, it's not something that you deliberate about a whole lot. It's almost like just an instinctive feeling as you're playing the game. You're like, oh my God.
I would think for hours this may be giving a game a 9 and 9.5, but giving a game a 10 is just, you just know it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then after you initially get that thought, you may spend some time to try to argue yourself out of it or argue yourself into it. Like, it's something that I think kind of dawns on you, and then you think about it later.
Yeah.
Whereas I think probably a lot of our reviewers, when they're giving scores, they kind of think about, well, this is okay, this part is good. You know, they think about it in these different ways, and they think, okay, what kind of score comes out of these feelings that I have about this game? But I think a 10 is a score that just kind of, bam, it just pops into your head.
You know,
and then you start to think, do I really want to do that? Can I really defend that, you know?
Yeah.
How can I defend it? For me, it's not that should I give it the 10? Should I try to defend that? It's more like, okay, how can I defend that? Because once I feel that a game should get a 10, I'm going to give it a 10. It's just a question of what kind of arguments can I come up with to get people off my back, because it is a dangerous, it's a controversial score. When you give a game a 10, you're going to have people saying, oh, you shouldn't do that, you know, you're giving it too much credit, or you're glossing over this and that and this and that. But it's kind of a personal, almost emotional type of score to give to a game. I think that sets it apart from a lot of the other scoring that we do in these reviews.
Yeah.
Well, I think a good example is, a lot of times when I'm thinking of, like, how I should score a game, I'll think, well, the final score can't be lower than any of the subcomponent scores, because that just doesn't make sense. But then I read your Ratatouille review.
Sometimes it can be.
Yeah, I read your Ratatouille review, and because there's no way to score, you know, in any of our subcategories, there's no way to score how blasphemous a game is or how not blasphemous it is.
Yeah, there are a lot of intangibles, you know. Yeah.
Maybe we should adopt an intangible subscore.
And I think it's possible for a game to get a 10, even if the subdivision scores, none of them are 10s.
Yeah, true.
I think if there's something just magical about the game,
you'd be hard pressed to find a game that was a 10 that didn't have at least one of its components.
Yeah, I'm not sure if any of our reviews have done that, but I think it's feasible. You know, I think it could happen one day.
Yeah, very true. You know, I mean, if you have a 9.5 in every category, that's an awesome experience in every way. So it could be a 10. So there you go.
I only gave Prince of Persia a 10 in the gameplay, or in the controls category.
Well, it did control very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was it. And that's only control. You know, I don't think really, when I think about video games, control is more of it's a technical score, and I don't really think it has much outcome. As good controls do not have an outcome on your final score, essentially. If your controls work and they are good, they have no factor on your final score.
That's a whole other discussion that we probably shouldn't get into right now.
Well, no, I want to make a quick point about that. And that, you know, with Prince of Persia especially, I think the control is a big part of it because it feels very fluid. And when you have that these really fluid controls that flow from you to the controller to the game, that creates an experience that could create a 10.
Okay, I'll give you that definitely. But I think what I should say is really is that good controls have much less of a bearing on a final score than bad controls.
Okay, yeah, I'll agree with that.
In general,
bad
yes.
Bad controls will tank your final score, in my opinion.
Now, Evan will argue against that. Evan will say that you can have a great game with terrible controls.
Resident Evil.
But anyway, that's why I say it's a separate discussion.
That's why Evan doesn't review mini games anymore. And there we go. And I think
we should just do an episode where we have Evan come on and refute like the past six episodes worth of content. Entirely.
I'll tell you what, he was talking to me about that art about the art session we had last week, and he is very in disagreement.
I would love to do that. And Evan Birchfield hates everything episode.
Oh, we should do that next week. It's the summer. There's
maybe
no news out.
If you're if you're lucky, you'll get that next week. But more than likely, you won't because Evan is impossible to get a hold of.
He's in Oregon. They barely have phones there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think that actually clears us up for this future discussion, guys. So let's go ahead and head over to the shill part of the podcast.
The unofficial fourth segment.
Yeah, the unofficial fourth segment. Well, fifth segment, really, because if you count the new business part that we have in the introduction. But anyway, so if you want to send us email, it's rfn@nintendoreport.com. Please go to iTunes, subscribe, leave a review if you can. And remember to dig us as well. There's a link on the site that you can hit and dig us, so do that.
But iTunes is way more important.
Well, you know, whatever you feel like, really. And Mike and Johnny, thanks for stopping by, and see all you guys next week.
Later, kids.
Cool. See you later.
All right, and we're back to the feature. You know, we got a lot of heavy-handed... let me start that over.
Yeah.
Alrighty.
Damn, dude, don't die, shit.
Oh, that's gonna get out of nowhere.